Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I'm your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we have the very good fortune of speaking with Tom Murphy, Associate Professor of Physics at the University of California, San Diego, and an avid writer on energy and growth-related matters at his website, Do the Math, which I believe is found at physics.ucsd.edu/do the math. Tom uses simple, easy to understand math, yes, that four-letter word, to logically, I say quite logically, make the case that simply extrapolating past trends in energy and economic growth is just not going to cut it. Instead, we face gigantic challenges and significant risks to our current model, not least of which is that when asked what we'll use when fossil fuels dwindle away, the most typical answer is, I'm sure we'll think of something. That is, our future of energy is a question mark right now. Here to discuss that question mark with us is Tom. Hey, real pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Chris. It's nice to be here.
First, your background for listeners, please, so they know how you came to write so eloquently about economic and energy matters.
Well, I don't know if I can really explain that. That's sort of almost a fluke. My background is in science and physics and astronomy, so I've been an avid fan of astronomy since high school. I built a large telescope in high school and was hooked on exploring the universe right away. Went to graduate school at Caltech, where I had the fortune to work on the venerable 200-inch telescope, the Palomar telescope, and built a spectrograph to look at colliding galaxies, and it was the first cryogenic integral field spectrograph ever built, so that was kind of fun to do. And after grad school, I saw the PhD as a license to have fun, and so rather than take the safe route of doing the same kind of infrared instrumentation for telescopes that I had been doing, and I had lots of opportunities to do that, I found this fledgling project that really I could start with a couple of guys at University of Washington to do lunar laser ranging at the millimeter precision. And this is really about measuring the Earth-Moon distance to 1 millimeter precision as a test of general relativity, because we can map the shape of the Moon's orbit and ask the question, does the Moon's orbit follow a prescription provided by general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity? And so this was just the perfect thing for me. It involved building instrumentation, optics, lasers on a telescope, but for a really interesting physics fundamental question. So I had all that I wanted. My dreams were satisfied. And then the big hit came. I took an assignment at UCSD in 2004 to teach a course on energy and the environment. And I went in bright-eyed and thinking, our future is going to be fantastic. That much I'm sure. I want to piece together what it's going to look like. I was vaguely aware that fossil fuels would play a diminishing role into the future. But, solar, wind, geothermal, nuclear, all these things surely would be enough. And I came out fairly confused by the process, because as I applied my physics and estimation skills to sort of set the scale of different things, how much can tidal power provide, or wind, or waves, the theme was disappointment. So I became really worried and spent years in this state, and finally decided I had to do something about it for no other reason for myself, to write down what I'd been thinking about, some of the calculations I'd done, and that's where Do the Math, how it was born.
Well, fantastic. So the themes I'm getting here are that, A, you personally have rolled up your sleeves and use technology, you love technology, you know what it can do, you've built instrumentation, so you have hands-on real-world experience of what technology can and in many cases can't do.
Right.
And you ran the numbers, and the numbers here are really the important part of this story, because most people are, I think, unaware of just the extraordinary throughput of energy that we're getting from fossil fuels, which I believe in one of your posts you likened to the fossil fuels that we're using are like a battery. The sun was raining all of this energy down on the earth, and it was being slowly, carefully accreted away and stored up into these things that we're now discharging in what, historically speaking, has to be considered a rather abrupt period of time. It's
almost a short circuit.
Almost a short circuit. Bzz, done, right? There was this huge potential energy and a live grounding wire wandered over and touched it, and that was our species. So there we are. All right, let's do some numbers then. I'm convinced that you and I, everybody alive today, is at a very unique, very critical point in human history, not just U.S. history or Asian history or European, human history. So here's some numbers. 7 billion heading to 9 billion. 100 quadrillion BTUs per year for the U.S. alone. Depletion rates of underground liquids of all sorts running at 3%, 4%, 5%, maybe even 10% or more, depending on what we're talking about. Are these the sorts of numbers you were looking at? And if so, I mean, why are these important? Why should average people suddenly concern themselves with things like this?
Well, I agree with the statement that we're at a very special time, and the way I like to visualize this in my own head is if you plot the use of fossil fuels over a very long period of time, say go back 10,000 years to the past, plot it to 10,000 years in the future, most of that is absolutely devoid of activity on the fossil fuel front. We just have a local blip that only lasts a few hundred years around now. And I think just on the fossil fuel part of the story, we are absolutely at a special time. This is the time when humanity has discovered the Earth's battery. And, you know, I also like to think we hooked up Las Vegas and there's your short circuit. And, you know, it's profligate, this energy that we use. And we've made good use of that energy. I am a huge fan of what we've accomplished as a byproduct of using this source of energy. But we have the tendency to extrapolate our future based on even a few generations is too short in the story because of that special blip of fossil fuel. And so I think, in my mind, stuff out to the right of this blip is a gigantic question mark. So I'm careful not to predict that the future will be brilliant or dismal, but the main message I want to get across is we really do not know. And to try to delude ourselves to thinking that we know what's coming is a very dangerous dangerous position, and we should approach this uncertain future with a lot more trepidation than I tend to see in the world around us.
I agree. I think there's a certain logical case, almost like a prosecutor that can be built out, which starts with, well, listen, there are some very clever things that we can do with technology, and we're hoping that we're going to apply some great technological solutions and maybe even some disruptive brand new technologies nobody has thought of that will really give us a bright future. Deductively, we come one step back and we say, in order for that technology to exist, it's very complex. All the moving parts required and knowledge necessary to build that technology requires a complex economy. And for the economy to function, therefore, one step from that, we're going to need constant throughputs of energy to maintain that complexity. And so as we sort of build this string through, everything sort of, to me, hinges at the bottom. We need to have not just energy flowing through, but high net energy flowing through. And so to get at this conversation, I want to start all the way out at that far end, back at the beginning of this. And so just to talk about just the economy for a minute, you had an excellent blog post entitled, "Can Economic Growth Last?" You posited that perpetual economic growth, it's just not mathematically improbable, but it's impossible. Let's start at the highest level. Why is that so?
Well, I think that fundamentally, economic activity is tied to energy. And, you know, you can have certainly activities that use more energy, some use less energy, and you have a lot of the bright future believers thinking that, well, our answer is simply to transition to low energy economic activities. And sure, there will be pressures to do those things, but you can't do 100% of your economy on even low energy things, not to mention no energy things. And so the point, and it's almost silly, it's mathematical, it's that if energy can't grow forever, and I think most of us would agree that on a finite planet, we can't just keep ramping up the raw energy use, then the fraction of our economy that's devoted to energy would have to trend toward absolute zero in order to keep the economy growing on top of a fixed energy supply. And that's just a non-starter for actual real activities that involve, for instance, eating. Nothing will ever go to zero energy, and as long as that's finite then and occupies a finite fraction of our economic activity, then the economy is capped.
Right. Well, we get out to some future point where we hit some steady state of energy usage. And I'll get to the excellent post you had about the silliness of thinking we'll just grow energy forever. But what a lot of people would say, and as a rejoinder to that, is to say, well, what about efficiency? Yeah,
right.
You know, even if we have less energy, we're going to use it more efficiently. And so maybe we can just count on us tinkering our way to a better future.
Yeah, and I think certainly here's another case where yes, that will happen, and that's an absolutely valuable goal to pursue. too, but it's not going to become the entire story, and it can't go forever. You know, there are lots of examples. If you think just what are typical efficiencies of devices today, you're going to come up with numbers between, say, 10 and 90%. Well, how much can you grow that before you cap out at 100? So right away, you can see that efficiency just doesn't take off, and it can't grow exponentially, for instance. Typical rates of efficiency improvement are something like 1% per year. We have maybe a factor of 2 or, you know, optimistically 4 or something in that neighborhood achieve an efficiency improvements, but there are real physical thermodynamic limits to all this. And so you can't expect at 1% per year, you double in 70 years. So we're talking about no more than a few centuries at most of progress at a 1% clip. And that rate would likely actually diminish over time because it gets harder and harder to improve efficiency. The low-hanging fruit is already gone.
Right. And to really improve efficiency, as you're mentioning, it's a slog, right? So this is very careful work. It takes a lot of people. Let's start with like electric motors. They're already 90% efficient. So there's really not a lot of either impetus or probably opportunity to really expand that much further. We could, but you know, we're getting very, very incremental changes there. And so this 1-2% efficiency gain, which is per year, that seems reasonable. Where are we in the fossil fuel story in your mind?
Well, I would say a typical heat engine, and that's how we tend to use fossil fuels. We burn them, and the heat engines have realized efficiencies going from maybe 10% for a generator at Home Depot up to 15-20% for cars, 30-40% for power plants. The highest kinds of numbers I tend to see are maybe 50% for a large diesel engine, say in a submarine or a ship. But you know, that's kind of where we are. The thermodynamic limits, if you just look at the an entropy kind of entropy controlled process where the total entropy in the whole system cannot decrease, you end up with a thermodynamic limit that is proportional to the temperature difference between your hot source and your cold source divided by the temperature of the hot source. You have to do this all in absolute temperature. But, you know, if you just do that calculation for a typical fossil fuel heat engine, you max out at something like 70 or 80%. And engineering practicalities tend to pull us back to maybe half of the theoretical maximum. And, you know, even if we slogged our way through the engineering practicalities and ended up at the thermodynamic limit, you know, we've got a factor 2 to gain. And even that, I think, is probably unrealistic.
So factor 2, so sake of argument, we stop all production of new internal combustion engines today, whether they're for ships or cars or trucks or trains, doesn't matter. We stop it today and we just start slogging along, assuming we could swap these engines out. We might be able to cut our fuel use in half over a pretty significant time with a lot of effort.
Right.
Right. And so let's cast back to the economy for a minute, which is constantly growing. So even if we were developing these fancy new engines that are much more efficient than current, I will note that China just increased its car consumption by 12.5% over the prior year, and that their projections, if you just keep going at their current rate linearly, they'll be buying 30 million vehicles per year by 2020, just almost twice what the U.S. was consuming at its clip, highest clip. So we see this massive growth in all of these combusting engines just going on, of course, as the rest of the world wants to catch up with U.S. standards. And so the idea to me here is that additional incremental growth in the ways in which we traditionally consume energy, in this part of the story I'm using standard internal combustion engines bought by Chinese citizens for cars, that the rate of growth of that 12.5% more cars this year than last year will swamp any 1 or 2% improvement, assuming those are happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the numbers you put out are very scary in the sense that we're really having trouble holding it together at today's world energy consumption levels. And the U.S. uses about a quarter of the world's energy, 20%, 25%, somewhere in that range, and with 5% of the population. So that means that the U.S. uses typically about 5 times the average energy use per person. And if the rest of the world wanted to come up to United States standards, we would see a world using 5 times as much energy tomorrow as we do today. And it's just not clear where that prosperity comes from, that energy prosperity. So we can maybe dream of that future, but right now we really don't have a roadmap to go from here to there.
Right. I noticed that all the projections for, say, fossil fuel or liquid fuels growth in the world, maybe by the next 10 years, will expand by about 9%, not 500%, as you were describing.
Right.
So yes, there are some constraints happening in there. Now, to me, the thing that's the risk in this whole story is that economies don't have to grow. There's no law written down. It's, you know, no world convention got together and cast it in stone and said this is how it has to be. But in truth, our money system, because it's based on debt-based money, does reasonably well when it's expanding and does extremely poorly as soon as it stagnates, let alone declines. To me, that's a lot of the metaphor of what we see happening in Europe. The pie stopped expanding and the whole thing sort of fell apart. And that's true for every exponential system like this that I've examined. It's kind of like either the reindeer on the island are expanding exponentially or they're, you know, collapsing exponentially. That these model, right. These systems tend to have, you know, two states, up or down. They have a very hard time transitioning to that steady state in between. So here we are. I want to get to the blog post that you had that I love the most was sort of this existential disconnect between you and an economist. And the blog post is Exponential Economist Meets Finite Physicist. Everybody should go out and Google that, find that article, read it. Because in there, you had some really good points. But just before I get into those, I'm just wondering, you've had some time to reflect on that conversation. And can you just characterize, set the stage for people, what that conversation was all about?
Yeah. So I was at a conference, and there was a keynote address. Banquet dinner, and I happened to sit next to a guy just, you know, by random chance that I'd seen earlier that day give a talk where he even talked about the chessboard with grains of rice and how quickly that got out of hand. And I was really excited when I saw the talk about he's going to deliver the punch here, and he didn't. You know, he didn't then claim that, for instance, economic growth can't continue forever, which I thought would have been fantastic coming from an economist. He stopped short of that. So, at finding myself sitting next to him, I decided to see what he would do with the statement that, you know, a blunt statement from me that exponential growth or that economic growth can't last forever. So, you know, he had the predicted response, whoa, 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 you know, what do you think? And so we got into it and had a very interesting conversation. You know, I think we were both very much engaged and doing our best to make our case. Now, I should mention for people who read the blog post that I tried to recreate his points of view, and that, of course, is not going to be a perfect process.
Sure,
I didn't
sure.
have a recorder at the time. But, you know, he did send me an email. He happened upon it and said he commended me for a job well done. He thinks I captured it fairly well.
Oh, nice. Good.
He said maybe not all the points are made the way I would have made them, or, you know, but the essence was there. And so I was very pleased with that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
So in the end, right, there are disconnects. And I've been thinking about those disconnects. I think it's very important to try to understand what they are. And so, in fact, this economist and I are going to try to work on some joint project to sharpen up that conversation. So I hope that goes forward. But the disconnects, there are several. One is that the economist speaks of growth and utility, and that utility doesn't have to be connected to physical form necessarily, and so that you can make improvements in the way your life is run, the way your house is configured, whatever, that don't necessarily require more energy. In fact, you know, some could require less energy, but are more pleasing in the end. So this gets very subjective very quickly. What's pleasing one person may not be pleasing to another, and I think the fundamental question, and he and I touched on this during the conversation, is someone 400 years in the future, do they have a lifestyle or elements of their lifestyle that are unambiguously better to someone 400 years in the past? So are there objective improvements in utility that can continue to essentially promote continued growth? And I would say that there probably are some of those things. So I'm trying to wrestle with how important are those? What fraction of what we do, because we still have to eat and we still have to consume energy. So what fraction of our economy can be in this form of unambiguous utility gain?
Well, now, this is an interesting conversation, and it's very important because as I cast back and I look, you know, I'm thinking back to the Monty Python movie, Holy Grail, and you've got the two serfs slopping around in the field, and they were living a very low energy existence at that point. I would argue that when we say better, one of the defining characteristics of our current lifestyle that people would defend to the death, I think, is that it's easy. We have this energy subsidy quietly, so quietly and so ubiquitously surrounding us that it's almost like being Neo in the Matrix. Like you can't even see it. It's just, it's everywhere. And to me, I am often filled with gratitude and very thankful of how many energy slaves I have, you know, humming around quietly, unseen, but certainly not unfelt in terms of the ease that's delivered to my life. So where I carry this is that to cast 400 years into the future, I understand we're going to make some improvements that will be energy neutral, maybe even require less energy, but that on balance, staying warm, moving myself from point A to point B, and being fed are extraordinarily energy intensive endeavors today.
Yeah, and important, and will never cease to be important.
No, absolutely. No, that those all are embody work. You know, protecting myself from the elements so that I'm comfortably warm or cool is work being performed, just very,
right.
Very unseen and very quiet.
And as a physicist, I have to point out that it will never take less energy to heat a coffee mug by 60 degrees C. In the future, it's going to cost the same number of joules as it does today to inject thermal energy into that coffee mug. So there are some things that are just inviolate in that sense.
Right. So any story of the future then has to really articulate where are these quadrillions of BTUs going to come from? Right. I mean, fundamentally, that's the story. And so as we look into our current energy landscape, we see that, yes, we've got this extraordinary flow coming from fossil fuels deposited over, call it about 400 million years. One of my favorite statistics is that in the last 22 years, so if somebody who's listening to this today is 22 years old, they've been alive when half of all the oil ever burned has been burned. Right, so even in the last 22 years, that's a very different experience from all of the years preceding those years, because that's an extraordinary throughput of energy, and that energy per capita has been rather explosively expanded in just the past 100 years, 200 years for sure. And so, if we're going to maintain that same number of say, however we want to measure it. Kilowatts per person per day, however we want to look at that.
Sure.
And we include the idea that the rest of the world, in order for the rest of the world not to, one of the arguments for why population is going to auto-stabilize is because living standards will come up across the whole world. And that's one of the only and probably the strongest correlating factor to why family sizes go down is economic opportunities improve, infant mortality declines, people feel safe in having smaller family sizes, bing, that happens. In order for that to happen, we have to imagine that energy use in the rest of the world, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, that will also have to expand rather extraordinarily. When we're talking at this scale, though, because I'm glad you had that course on energy. Talk to me about the gap that exists currently between what we might get from, let's call it renewables, but I'm thinking anything. So call it geothermal, solar, plus wind. So we've got, and tidal. So I think that's about everything except for nuclear that doesn't come from fossil fuels. What is the gap that currently exists between the number of BTUs we're getting from that and what we would have to embark on in order to significantly and then finally entirely replace what we get from fossil fuels?
Well, the gap currently is obviously huge. Almost all of our energy comes from the fossil fuels. But, you know, the optimists would say that's just because it's easy and cheap right now. We could easily transition to solar, for instance, which is super abundant in its delivery of energy to the planet's surface. The numbers there are quite impressively large. Wind, less so. That's a secondary manifestation of solar power. Waves are a tertiary manifestation of solar power through wind. And so as you cascade down, you get less and less energy in hydroelectric, for instance. And so most of the really fancy, neat ideas that we hear about are maybe clever, but just don't stack up in terms of abundance. There are some that are truly abundant in nature, and solar being one of them, but there's a real disconnect between what solar offers and what we're trying to replace. So it turns out we don't have much trouble generating electricity. There are loads of ways to make electricity. What's really missing is the liquid fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very difficult to transition from solar or nuclear or whatever you want into the liquid fuels, which allows us to move ourselves around. It's very important in agriculture. And I think that's where the pinch point will come. come, there are certainly sources that can be labeled as abundant. So the Gulf is really one of practicality more so than one of the sheer energy scale. And that's a little bit harder to quantify. So you can quantify the abundance and how much you might get out of a certain source, but it's very hard to quantify things like public acceptance or how difficult it will be to pull off, things like intermittency, how to deal with them, storage, practical storage solutions. All of these are very tricky. And I guess, one perspective is that we've known since 1970, roughly, that the fossil fuel peak was coming at some point. And we knew that we needed alternatives. And in the 70s, we had lots of discussion of alternative energies. 40 years later, we're really, honestly, not that much further along. We sort of don't have any new players. And it feels to me that if the liquid fuels decline is in the next few decades, which I think is likely, we've already got the players on the stage right now. And so all of these technologies take a long time to develop and mature and scale. So I'm not, even though I'm a fan of technology, I'm not a fan of gambling on the sense that some entirely new source will come along that is as yet unappreciated and sweep the field. So the fact is that our alternatives are deficient in various ways compared to the ease and abundance and convenience of the fossil fuels.
Right. I want to just take a moment here to note that you ran the calculations and said that if we grow our energy consumption at a steady 2.3% per year, which gives us a handy little device, which I believe is that, what, in 100 years, we increase our use of energy by a factor of 10? Yeah, and so that's very very modest, 2.3%. It's less than we've been expanding it since the 1600s. So 2.3% per year from here on out. In 440 years, say, the surface of the Earth is now at the temperature at which water boils, just because of the waste heat from this energy that we're consuming. So let's imagine for the moment this low energy nuclear reaction is real, or some other fancy thing where we actually can get unlimited energy. In fact, if we just use that in a status quo way of just expanding on a constant basis, we would figure out well before the Earth's surface reached the temperature of boiling water, we'd go, this is a bad idea. We gotta stop, change something here.
Right.
And that within less than 1,000 years, the Earth's surface would be at the temperature of the sun if we were going to continue that process out. And so those might sound like big sweeps of time. Oh, 1,000 years, we'll have a lot of time to figure that out. But I want to mention historically, it's not a huge amount of time. Like, here's a fact that sort of caught me short when I heard it. Cleopatra was born closer to the launching of the space shuttle than she was to the building of the Great Pyramids by 500 years. So it turns out that, if you're talking to an Egyptian, the several thousands of years of history is actually nothing. So historically speaking, we know that somewhere between here and there, we're going to have to find a way to get to a steady state model of some kind.
At best. And so that implies a gigantic transition. And it's not a transition that really many people are talking about. The fundamental assumption that seems to go on is that it's more of the same, and we just extrapolate.
Well, exactly. And so here we are. I just read in the paper, very disappointing piece of news to me, that some senators are very excited by pushing an idea to build some more LNG terminals, because Asia is really hungry for LNG, particularly Japan right now. We've got a lot of gas, so we'll build these terminals. And disappointing to me, because the mindset embodied in that is to say, look, we have this resources. Our job is to use it up as fast as possible. And since we can't use it fast enough on our own soil, what we'll do is we'll liquefy it at great energetic cost. It costs a lot of energy to take a gas and turn it into a liquid, especially when we're talking about methane. You might lose 25% of the embodied energy that was existing in that gas before you ran through that process. Poof, gone. And so this makes sense to us. It makes sense economically. It makes sense politically. Might even make sense socially from a jobs perspective, but it doesn't make energetic sense, and it doesn't make historical sense. And so the question becomes, how do we start to reshape that narrative so we can start at least having the right discussion? It's got to involve these numbers. What sort of a reception do you have in trying to get these numbers out there? Do you just end up talking to other numerate individuals? Or I like the success you've had with The Economist, but I consider them to be very numerate, obviously. That's their profession.
Right. I don't think I would characterize it as success, actually. I mean, I don't really think I changed the economist that I talked to. I don't think I really changed his mind fundamentally. I think he sort of understood that, okay, maybe energy is capped, and he did sort of make some progress during the conversation, in my view. But I don't think fundamentally he walked away thinking growth doesn't go on forever. I don't think I changed his mind on that at all in the economic sense. So I think that's fundamentally important, that we need to get over the notion that growth is just a constant of nature. It's part of who we are. It is part of who we have been for quite a few generations now. But, you know, I like to throw out a couple examples of cases where that's not really true, because in the early part of the 20th century, we had this amazing pair of technological progress that from the time it was conceived that a nuclear reaction take place in the late 30s until the time that it was, or maybe it's early 30s, but the time scale from the discovery of that process of fission to a reactor was less than a decade.
Mm. Yeah.
And so then it was thought that nuclear fusion was the next big goal. And yeah, okay, we've achieved that in nuclear bombs, but not in some steady, controlled sense. And that's been 60 years since the first attempts at fusion, and no success. So we sort of hit a wall. Some of our expectations haven't been satisfied. When we broke the sound barrier, people thought, okay, well, there's the next step in transportation. We even got the Concorde. But that doesn't fly anymore. It was beyond our means to sustain that expensive mode of travel. And I'll also point out that we went to the moon in the late 60s and felt that this was our destiny, to be a space race of peoples. And the U.S. no longer has the capability to launch a human into space. Those should be red flags waving at us, that our assumptions about this ever-up trajectory are sometimes extraordinarily wrong.
Right. So, yeah, great point. You know, we have the Moore's Law, which gets waved at me quite regularly, and because we've had tremendous success at pushing these boundaries with one aspect of technology, which is on silicon chips. And so I guess the extrapolation from there is, therefore, you know, we don't experience boundaries in anything we do. But you've just identified a number of places where, yeah, we ran up against some walls and found that pushing beyond those walls was, for whatever reason, just extraordinarily expensive in some terms, that caused
right.
us to have to back off of that and say, you know, maybe 500 miles an hour is a good speed for a plane, you know, and that makes sense. And so, you know, as I look at this, I'm just looking at the time, the cost of trying to meet the scale of what I see the predicament of declining net energy and soon to be possibly declining overall amounts of aggregate forms of energy from fossil fuels. And whether that's this year, 10 years, or 20 years, blink of an eye, historically speaking, and certainly given the level of the implications of what the repercussions of that might be, extraordinary. And there's opportunities embedded in that story, and there's challenges. But given the challenges, one of the things that I've come to in my life is to say, you know, very high chance, I'm a betting man, so I'm throwing a six-sided die. I think five sides of that die say higher energy prices going forward. And there's a chance that maybe I'll be surprised and energy becomes less of my disposable income. But my response to that was to make my house as energy resilient as possible. And, you know, air sealing and figuring out how we use energy, putting some solar thermal panels on, managed to, without really a whole lot of effort, cut my energy use a lot without noticeably impacting my standard of living or quality of life in particular.
Yeah, I've gone down the same road, and I agree exactly with your conclusion.
So, yeah, could you tell us what you've done there?
Most of it really just comes through consciousness, realizing that energy is a precious thing, that we can't rely on it being ever abundant, ever cheap. And so I wanted to understand, what does it mean to reduce energy use? And so most of it was just kind of waking up, looking at what I do, measuring, metering. I'm a huge fan of data collection and measurement. So that formed a baseline against which I could judge my actions. And so we stopped heating our house. Now, I live in San Diego, and many people might just actually get angry hearing that that's a big sacrifice, but it's unusual in San Diego.
Yep.
For someone to not use heat in their house. So we, you know, line dry our clothes. I take the bus to work. I put on some solar panels that I built up this system myself with batteries, so it's off-grid. I have sort of a dual electric system in my house. Some things run on solar, some are on utility. But overall, even including those, I'm at less than 5 kilowatt hours a day, and a factor of 5 or so below the national average and a factor of maybe 3 or 4 below the San Diego average. Mm-hmm. And so there are lots of places where I've made large cuts, factors of 2 and 3 and 4 and bigger compared to even my local cohort. And yeah, I still live the same basic life that I did before. So that's given me a lot of encouragement. Large cuts are possible. That can have a tremendous sort of purchase power, if you will, when we're hit with an energy decline scenario. Now, my changes were voluntary. Your changes were voluntary. I think these things feel a lot different when they're not, which is part of my reasoning for deciding to take control of it rather than be controlled. There's this one phenomenon that I call the energy trap that I think we really need to pay some attention to, which is once we enter into a, say, energy decline, a year-by-year decline, and realize that, oh, shoot, this is because fossil fuels are petering out. Liquid fuels will be first, petroleum. We really need to invest heavily in an energy infrastructure, a new infrastructure, to replace our fossil fuel use. That's going to take a lot of energy. And if you're already running short on energy, that demand for a new significant influx of energy has to come from somewhere, and it makes your perceived energy decline steeper. That's politically very difficult to affect.
Yes, but if we had the right story, we could do it. And you know, one of my favorite examples is, you know, people what today would be considered sacrificed a lot for World War II. They didn't call it sacrifice at the time. That was their war effort, and they were all behind it because we had a narrative that said we're going to defeat Nazis, and that was worth it, and so we did it.
Yep.
Right now, I don't think anybody's really looking at the story and saying, here's something we really have to do. In fact, we're still talking about how we can use our energy up as fast as possible instead of saying, where do we want to be in 40, 50 years, and how are we going to get there? And that's what every good business has to do. We should do that in our own lives, but as a former strategy consultant, we'd wander into businesses and say, where do you want to be? How are you going to get there? That's all that's required for a good strategy. And I don't know that we have either of those two conversations happening at the national level right now, which is, I guess, why you do what you do and why I do what I do.
Exactly. And I do think that it's physically possible to navigate ourselves to a steady state and technologically advanced future, but it's psychologically very difficult to make the sacrifices, that near-term sacrifices that are going to be needed. So I think the other difficulty here is that when we rose to gigantic challenges in the past, like World War II, we had an enemy with a human face, and that human face could be demonized. That's what we tend to do during wartime. If it's a problem of energy and energy use, we are our own enemies. That's the psychological problem. We have to acknowledge that we are our own problem, and the changes that we need to make are directed at our own habits. So in World War II, you might have somebody motivated to go work in a bomb factory and painting, you know, dye you whatever, fill in the enemy of the time, on the bombshell. How are we going to mobilize people in World War II, we had hate on our side. That's a very powerful motivator. How are we going to learn to hate our own energy use enough to do something significant about it at that scale?
I agree, and that's why I think the narrative has to be framed around the hope side, which is, you know, we can wrap in legacy, we can talk about what's being responsible, we can talk about... ultimately, I see us as the larger metaphor here is that we as a culture came through our adolescence, right? And like all good adolescents, we were growing. That's what your body does. But sooner or later, your body has to stop growing and you have to adjust to that, or you'll end up, you know, being very heavy. And so here we are at the point where there are no more horizons to go over. There's no more, you know, big untapped resources. We're pretty much got it all mapped out. And so the question is, how are we going to manage that now? So ultimately, we're talking about a transition into adulthood. And so that, I think, is a very hopeful conversation, because it says, you know, what was important to us in the past as teenagers might not be the same things that are important to us as adults. And that's okay. That's perfectly normal. It's natural. We've got analogs for it. Ultimately, what I'm really, my personal story around this is that I have cut my standard of living in half. I've probably doubled my quality of life. I'm pretty sure that if I can do it, anybody can do it. That this consumptive treadmill I was on turned out to be something I was very good at. I was born, bred, raised, and trained for it. And when I got off of it, in my case, initially motivated by some anxiety, if not fear, about what I saw coming, I realize now I would willingly jump into that landscape because of what I find there. I'm being pulled rather than pushed towards it. And so to me, that is my motivation, is to say, not only can we get off of this ridiculous treadmill we're on, which has no future, by the way, unsustainable, and step into this new life, but it's actually something we want to do. And it's the it's time to do that. And we either do it or we don't. I'm a scientist at heart, trained in the physical sciences, natural sciences, and I just know that limits are limits. And you know, we will, like any organism, discover our limits, and we will either discover that on our own terms or some other terms.
Well, I think part of my difficulty in all this is I have the sense and the intuition that we face unprecedented challenges that will prohibit us from continuing apace, from growing. And I have the sense that the technologies that we would like to use to replace fossil fuels are impractical from, say, the point of view that it's easy to make electricity and we can make that in all kinds of renewable ways that don't involve fossil fuels. But getting that into the transportation fleet requires electric vehicles. And yes, we can do that, but how many people can afford them? Do we price ourselves out of a post-fossil future that looks much like today's world? And so I have a sense that all of that is very, very hard and maybe a challenge that humanity is not up for. But the awkward aspect of this is that as a scientist, I can't prove that. I just have an intuition. But that same intuition has been very useful and an extremely powerful guide for me as a scientist to pick problems that are approachable and to pick technologies that don't have showstoppers. And I've explored plenty of possible projects in science that I just had an uneasy feeling about the technological state and shied away. And in hindsight, those were all very good decisions. So I think I have to trust my own intuition at some level and feel that, yes, this is a really hard, unprecedented time in the progress of humanity, and we should just pay attention to that. It's a message that most people don't really want to hear, and so it's a real challenge to get people to accept that maybe we should slow down, maybe we should aim for steady state, even if it's just a temporary phase, and then we realize, oh, it wasn't really necessary in the most optimistic of scenarios. But I'm realizing that I have conservative tendencies here. I want to take the lowest risk approach to the future because so much is riding on it. And personally, I feel that the scientific progress that we've made over the last few hundred years is astounding. I don't want to lose that. I think that's a gift to the future, and I don't want to run the risk of a collapse that could destroy all that we have. And even if you think the collapse is a low probability, let's say it's 5%, 10% probability, it's an asymmetric risk. The downsides of not treating it seriously are huge. I mean, you buy fire insurance for your house, even if it's a 0.1% probability that your house will burn down in your lifetime, but the consequences are so negative that you do it. And I think when you're talking about the accomplishments of all civilization, we need to buy insurance and treat that with the respect it deserves.
Very well said. And I couldn't agree more. So we're going to have to leave it at that today. I wish you the best of luck with the Economist. I do hope you two continue your conversation. I would love to be privy to whatever comes from that and hear about it, because it's a very important conversation. We have to start having it. And I want to thank you for our conversation today. Just incredible stuff that you've done. I love your blog. How can tell people quickly how they can follow you more closely?
Well, I would just say Google Do the Math, and you'll find my blog. I've kept a weekly pace up for the last almost a year, but I'm dropping off to once every 2 weeks for a while I get other aspects of my life in order. It's a very time-consuming thing, it turns out. And it's been a nights and weekends deal because my job is very demanding. So, you know, I'm sort of, I feel like I've just run a marathon, but I will continue to post on all of these same kinds of topics.
Well, and it's an important body of work that's already there. So I would invite people to wander over and read it through it. It's very good. Do the Math. Tom, thank you so much for your time today and an engaging conversation.
Yeah, thanks. It's been fun.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.